Blog Talk Radio.
As it was, as it is, as it evermore shall be, though triumph sacred three, be with me, with the ebb, with the flow, be with me.
Welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Whether you're across town or across the globe, I thank you for tuning in and for sending all the great emails, guest ideas, and articles to share. Our Voices of the Sacred Feminine family is really growing by leaps and bounds. And thanks, too, for sharing the show with your friends and for marking the show a favorite on Blog Talk. You know what? I'm having a problem with my switchboard. Eleanor, can you still hear me?
I hear every word you say very clearly.
Okay. All right. Okay. So back to where I was. Tonight, our guest is the Foremother Eleanor Gadden. I'm so glad to finally have her on the show. I guess we must have been suffering from Mercury retrograde on some past occasions when she was supposed to be with us, but we have her on tonight. I'm sure you have her book like I do, The Once and Future Goddess. She's going to discuss women's spirituality, empowerment, and the meaning of life. And, of course, I'm going to get her to take on the ideas and share with us how things have changed since she began this journey and what she sees ahead for our movement. Then, please stay tuned for what some of you call the favorite part of the show, when I let those bees that have buzzing around in my bonnet out. If you're not familiar with What's the Buzz, it's when we talk about things going on out there in the world that are in sync with or opposing ideals of the sacred feminine. And just some of those ideals include partnership, justice, balance, harmony, tolerance, negotiation, wisdom, and certainly not exploitation of Mother Earth, resources, or people, especially women. You've been telling me you want to hear more on these issues, or to go in depth a bit more, or not to rush What's the Buzz. So I'm working on that, and I'm glad for your feedback. And so you'll know what's ahead in What's the Buzz. Our topics tonight fall under the heading of sex, power, and politics, just like the theme of my YouTube video. One of the first things I'm going to cover is from the Ms. blog, and I love this title of the article, White Men Clutch Their Pearls as Justice John Paul Stevens Steps Down from the Supreme Court. Then there's Japan. It drops in the global ranking of sex equality. We're going to talk about Sarah Palin's Pinnacle of Hypocrisy, why we still blame victims of rape, France's President Sarkozy, he's banning the burqa, and the new abortion bill that requires vaginal probes, ultrasounds, and a collection of private data. And as part of my ongoing mantra about the dumbing down of America, we have the article about the Tea Party crowd needs to wake up to who the real villains are. And finally, the virginity industry. Very interesting. Women are having their hymens reattached. So stay with me till the bottom of the show. We'll cover these themes. We'll open the show to callers, share some important announcements, and some great music. So remember, to speak with me or my guest, please call 718-766-4662. I know from your emails, most of you listen from the archives, but if you're there live with us, please do call in and say hello or offer your comments. And thanks to our new artists who have generously allowed me to play their music for your enjoyment on the show. For tonight's opening, you just heard a snippet from Triple Goddess from the very talented local L.A. artist Lisa Thiel. But if you want more information about the music, Lisa's website is sacreddream.com. And you'll be hearing more of her music here because I love everything she does. And at the bottom of the hour, I might let you hear a little bit more of Leah Scallon's music from her CD, The Sounds of Sirius. very ethereal and appropriate for our closing prayer. And for those of you who have asked me where I get information for the show, oftentimes it's listeners who send in articles or comments they want me to share. Other times I go to my favorite sources who I trust for reporting truth and accuracy, which seems to be in short supply sometimes these days. You've asked me who my favorites are. Well, here are a few. My two favorite television commentators are Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann, both on MSNBC. Let's see, there's also the Ed Show. It's quickly becoming a favorite. He's kind of an everyman speaking for the people, not the corporations. And he's not afraid to call out lying Republicans or teabaggers who just don't have their facts right because they're too busy listening to Fox. Or go to the Nation magazine online or to the Alternet online blog, Ms. Blog, the blog of Phyllis Chesler, all good sources for what's happening out there in the world in keeping with ideals working for or against ideals of the sacred feminine locally and globally. And now to tonight's guest, Foremother Eleanor Gadden. Eleanor, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Eleanor, first, let me ask you, do you have a speakerphone on by any chance? Because I keep hearing my voice echoing in the background.
Oh, you do. I don't know. Let me look and see if there's a speakerphone or something.
Okay.
Hello, does that make a difference?
Oh, it sure does.
Oh, okay.
I'm still hearing myself, but
Well, then I'm going to shut this off.
Okay.
Because what I did was turn on the speakerphone, but I don't seem to be able to shut it off. Wait a minute.
Okay. Well, are you hearing an echo, or am I just hearing an echo?
Only you're hearing an echo. I don't hear an echo.
All right. Well, then I'm not going to worry about it then. I can just ignore it.
Okay.
Well, let me start out by telling my listeners a bit about your background, just in case they aren't one of the lucky ones to have your book on their shelf.
Okay.
Eleanor,
it's still in print after 21 years. So,
and I know why. That the once and future goddess, a symbol for our time, and it still is a relevant symbol of our time. Well, Eleanor is a cultural historian whose research interests and publications are focused on the analysis of myth and image in their cultural context as they affect issues of gender. Her academic training, teaching, and publications are both interdisciplinary in art history, history of religions, and cultural anthropology, as well as multicultural. Her specialty is the art and culture of the Indian subcontinent. Her major publication, which we've mentioned a few times, and it's worth mentioning over and over again, is The Once and Future Goddess, subtitle, Symbol of Our Time. It's a visual chronicle of the history of the sacred female and her reemergence in the cultural mythology of our time. She's currently working, are you still currently working on two projects for publication, Eleanor?
Yes, and one is finished, which is The Village Goddess of India, the First Religion. So that I'm preparing now to find a publisher.
Oh, okay, wonderful. And let's see, the rest of your bio says that you've taught at the Harvard Divinity School, Tufts University, University of California in Santa Barbara, and Mills College, where you were an associate scholar in the Women's Leadership Program. And you developed and directed an MA and PhD in women's spirituality at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco.
That's right.
So does that about cover it?
Well, there's more, but that's enough.
Okay. Well, Eleanor, we've been looking forward to having you on the show, and the topic that we sort of talked about you covering, it can be so very wide-ranging. You said you wanted to talk about women's spirituality, empowerment, and the meaning of life. I mean, that can be pretty heavy.
Well, I think that a woman's spirituality actually is what gives meaning to her life, because it's embodied and not transcended, and it's rooted in her life experience and in what she holds most sacred. So this is what gives meaning to her life.
So how did you come to this, Eleanor? I mean, what was your background originally? Were you a Christian? Are you still a Christian?
No, I was never a Christian. I grew up in a non-observant Jewish family, and my interest in religion has really been as well. I was at the University of Chicago, where the understanding of religion doesn't come from your own personal experience. Rather, as my professor said, like you're on the moon and you look down at all the religions of the world. I feel that religion is culture and culture is religion. So in my enormous curiosity about culture and everywhere in the rest of the world, I felt, or I came to see the way the toe in was to learn about religion. So then I came to be teaching world religions for years.
So how, you know, well, you know, obviously this, you know, this wonderful book you've written is about goddess. Do you consider yourself a feminist, a goddess advocate? Do you see a feminine face of God as deity, archetype, or ideal?
Well, I certainly am a feminist, and I came to see, to be interested in the goddess at first because 40 years ago I lived in India, not as a scholar, but because my husband, or my then husband, was teaching there for the at the Indian Institute of Management in Calcutta for MIT, and that was the most wonderful, wonderful year of my life. I felt that I had Aladdin's lamp, and all I had to do was rub it, and something wonderful would happen. But India is, or certainly Calcutta is about as far as you can get from New England, so that everything was a wonder. But what was particularly awe-inspiring for me, really mind-blowing, was the goddess, because in those days, that is 40 years ago, we didn't talk about the goddess in the West. And we hadn't yet had all those wonderful books on the recovery of the prehistoric goddess. And to hear, to be in a place, particularly Calcutta, where the goddess reigns supreme. It's Kali, the goddess, who reigns supreme there. It's her hometown. But to be in this place, and she's not exactly a nice lady. She's nothing like the Virgin Mary. So, but a very powerful female figure, female deity. And
well, Eleanor, let me ask you this. If you spend so much time there, and, you know, the Hindu goddesses are not my forte, I admit that, and so maybe you can shed some light on this lack of understanding I have. With India being the country where goddess reverence has never ended, you know, the one place where it continues on for thousands of years, why do you think there hasn't been more women's empowerment? Why are the people still in such dire straits? I know some of the scholars I know talk about the spousification of the Hindu goddesses. Is that something you believe as well? Do you think that has something to do with it?
Well, from a certain point of view, that's true. In the high pantheon of the Brahmanic gods, they all have a wife. However, Kali is nobody's wife. Durga, Kali and Durga are the two important goddesses, the major goddesses, pan-Indian goddesses, and neither of them have a consort. So that's only one piece of information. There is a continuity in the Indian subcontinent going back 5,000 years to the earliest civilization, which we call the Indus Valley or the Harappan civilization. And there, although we don't understand their writing, so that we haven't been able to translate that. But the early archaeologists in the early 20th century who excavated there said that in every household he found a small figurine, a small female figurine, which he assumed was the goddess.
But why did it not translate into more women's empowerment or people's empowerment?
Well, it isn't. Actually, there are empowered people in India, but certainly most, and not too many women. Because the empowerment of women is a political, not a religious issue, and India is patriarchal, as patriarchal as any country, any civilization, you know, that we have. So it's the politics that. Rather than the religion that make you know, the women's position. However, even with the fact that the plight of women is not good, and for many they're certainly are subservient, That's on one way of looking at it. Another way, the women's power in terms of her sexual power, her is very much part of the culture. And also her sacred power, so that you have to think of, there are different ways of slicing this. So if you think in terms of something, a word they use called auspiciousness, you need the woman's auspiciousness in order to properly do any kind of a sacred ritual. So the practitioner, the male, has to have a wife in order to perform these rituals.
I see. But I guess in terms of everyday life with so much poverty, I guess the caste systems and things like that, the way we think of the personal is political, that doesn't really translate there, I guess.
No, first of all, it's a culture or a society in which people don't think about the personal in that way. It's a more, instead of I, it's a we kind of place. You're always embedded in a family situation, in a context. So that's one thing. Of course, there are, you know, the world, globalization is out there, and the world is changing, and there's certainly in big cities like Delhi or Mumbai or Calcutta, there are contemporary feminist women who have some of the same ideas that feminists have here. But that isn't so in the vast majority of population in the subcontinent. One place where women's power is still or has always been manifest is with the tribals. Now, in my most recent research project in the state of Orissa, which is 25% tribal, women there are it's an egalitarian society for the most part, and women there are the powerful priestesses. And they who perform the rituals, they have as much power as anybody in the community.
Okay. So you were right there in the heart of all of this. Did
yes.
you go to all, you know, did you go to many of the Shakti pithas and you know, the places where the goddess was you know, revered
yeah.
most? I think that's mostly in southern India, isn't it?
No, it's all over. For instance, the most sacred of the Shakti peats, it's P-I-T-H-S, but it's still pronounced like Pete.
Thank you. Okay.
That is in Assam, which is in northeastern India. And that's the place where the yoni, that is the vulva of the goddess, fell. Now, the myth behind this is wonderful because it's, or wonderfully imaginative. The god Shiva, who is the most important male god, wife Sati committed suicide because of her humiliation when her father didn't invite her husband to his important festival. Ritual festival. So and Shiva was filled with grief, and he took her charge. What Sati did was jump into the ceremonial fire, the ritual fire, and she burned to death. So he took her charred body, and in grief was wandering all over the subcontinent. And the gods were very concerned because they needed Shiva's god work to keep things going. So another god, Vishnu, came down and was following him around. In each place, he cut off a piece of Sati's body. And wherever that fell, that's one of the places where we now have a Shakti pit. And there maybe are 64 of them. Some people say 81, but mostly 64. And they're scattered all over the subcontinent.
Okay. And so here you're in the middle of all of this. And
yes.
So was being there in India would influence you to become interested in the many faces of goddess?
Certainly, when we talk about, you know, in India, it's very interesting. There's many gods, but there's one word for goddess, which is Devi, D-E-V-I, although there are many forms, many manifestations of Devi. When I went there, and again, you'll have to go back 40 years and realize that we didn't really have a woman's, much of a woman's movement then, and certainly we didn't have any interest in the or knowledge about the prehistoric goddesses in the West. But to come to a place where, like Calcutta, where the dominant deity was a female, was mind-blowing for me. And it caused me to think through, I mean, certainly to give some thought to how trapped we were in what I call monotheistic religions and the hegemony of God the Father, the fact that people, that are, as even someone like the director of my institute, when I first went there, the research institute I'm part of in Boston, when I first went there, and she, I gave her my book, and she said, oh, I didn't know this is a prominent sociologist. She said, I didn't know there was anything before God the Father. Even the idea that there was in prehistory is much longer than history, and that for from going back to the Paleolithic, people worshipped an Earth Mother.
So this was, you know, for, you were definitely one of the trailblazers then, because as you said, you know, you didn't have the benefit of books like yours to have introduced you to, you know, what this could potentially mean for, you know, for politics, for women's psyches as archetypes, all of that.
It's very important because, as Carol Christ, the philosopher Carol Christ has said, the idea of having a god or god in your own image is enormously empowering, and that we didn't have this in the world, in the monotheistic world in which we lived here, so that there was no way that a woman could feel that there was a god or a deity in her image.
Right. Yeah. And we well, I guess those of us now who can benefit from books like yours and Carol Christ and all of this that has come before us, we're so very lucky that we at least, you know, had this at our disposal. We didn't have to uncover it all. You've done all that hard work for us.
Oh, thank you. You know, one of the interesting things, it isn't like in Orissa, which is the state in eastern India that I did my most recent research. They celebrate the menses, the menstruation of the goddess. That's a major festival in June of the year. And it's so interesting what this festival is about, because it's a play in the villages where they celebrate this. The women take time out. The women don't, from all their household work, they have 4 days in which they can just play, and they like to swing and sing and dance, and the men do all the work. And the reason this is because the goddess is menstruating, and so she should, the women should rest when the goddess is menstruating, as the goddess should rest.
Oh, I love that idea.
All right, but it's so significant in terms of the seasonally, because this is right before the rains come, and they won't start plowing and putting the or sowing the seeds, that is, until the rains come. So the menstruation then of the goddess is an analogy for the rains that will come and make possible the fertility of the soil.
That's a wonderful metaphor. Well, so Eleanor, how many years were you actually living there?
In the last 10 years, I was there more than half the time. But then I lived there the first year for a whole year. But I really didn't do any research then. I was just sort of taking in this. I thought I had Aladdin's lamp, and I was just going around rubbing it and seeing whatever wonders came my way. Then when I had small children then. So when they were older, I went back to graduate school and got a PhD in Indian religion, art, and culture, so which you can do at the University of Chicago. It's an interdisciplinary degree, and with my focus on India. And then that isn't the only thing that I do, but it's been the bulk of my own research and teaching.
So it seems to me then that you've sort of taken this in and have made this your spirituality of choice as opposed to what you were born into.
Yes, well, I didn't really know. My parents were non-observant Jews, and I didn't know about spirituality. The only spiritual person I think I ever encountered in my childhood was my beloved grandmother, but that wasn't a word that I knew about. And it's very different than organized religion, what I mean by spirituality or women's spirituality, because it's something that hasn't received much attention in world religions, which are mostly from the viewpoint of men's experiences.
Right.
And
well, how has you know, taking women's spirituality as your own, you know, how has that given your life meaning? I mean, how has it been different from you than, say, had you followed your Jewish roots?
Well, what I describe as women's spirituality is my own experience, a woman's sense of the sacred, my connection to nature, my experience of my body and my emotions. This is very important because women need to be in touch with their body and their feelings. My development, my psychological development within the context of my body, sexuality, and spirit. And those are not separate. They are, from my perspective, they're all integrated, and that part of who, what our persona is. And then I think that this sense, for me, women's spirituality is connected to our moral reasoning and ethics. I mean, if you feel yourself part of nature, which I do, certainly you have a sense then of the sacredness of nature.
Yes, and I mean, obviously, so many of us have lost that interconnection, and look where it's gotten humanity, quite frankly.
Well, as I end up the Goddess book saying that the interconnection of all of life, we're part of nature, and nature is part of us.
So, what do you think is some of the most important points you would share with our listeners? You know, whether they're new to Goddess spirituality or they've been doing this for a while. You know, what has been most important or the most substantive for you?
Well, I think the sense of relational, that the women's spirituality is a relational thing, that it's the connection to family, friends, and nature, and that body and spirit aren't separate, and particularly sexuality is sacred. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, an intimate, you know, and this is something that really concerns me when I see that even my students, I remember how horrified I was when I taught at the Harvard Divinity School years ago, and my graduate students told me that they didn't, you know, their sexuality was just totally instrumental and wasn't sacred. Well, when a woman does that, it's brutalizing for her, and I'm afraid that's what most women do.
Well, that almost puts it in the realm of... I don't know, I hate to use the word prostitution, but I mean, there's no sacredness to it, there's no intimacy to it, it's just sort of a clinical act. Is that what you mean?
Right, but it's not the same as prostitution, because that's something
you're
that
not selling it, yeah.
That women do for money. But it is instrumental, and that's and the fact is, and we need to have this in education for in elementary school, because young women are becoming, or not just the women, but girls and boys are becoming sexually active by the time they're 12. And that's, which is, I felt, I know this way about my own children, that when they were, I had boys and girls, I said they weren't old enough to be sexually active until they, you know, understood the full implications of what it was.
Right. So, Eleanor, how have things changed since those early days? I mean, do you have hope that we are shifting into a more positive paradigm where these ideals of the sacred feminine might take hold? I mean, do you have reason for hope?
Not much, alas. I think that there are more people are aware, and I know that you need to think that at least 12% of the population holds an idea before a paradigm can take over. But globalization, if anything, when we're certainly a product of globalization in our culture, is more patriarchal, more masculine. Well, not so much patriarchal as it's a masculine kind of thing. And it really, and so the women have find, for instance, in order to climb up to the glass ceiling or even possibly break through, they just have to be just like the men. That's one thing. And that the pressures that I see this and the impact of globalization on village India where I is devastating, because the corporate, for instance, the tribals and 25% of the population where I just was are in the area of Orissa where all the rich mines are, and they're all owned by multinational corporations. And the whole way in which the impact is that people are displaced from their homes, are displaced from their communities and given a pittance, which the men drink up right away, and then they end up in the slums of the big cities as casual workers. And that's the impact of globalization on, in Orissa, which is a state that has 40 million people.
Well, do you think, so obviously, that and sadly, that doesn't seem like that's much hope for Orissa. But what about for us in the West? Are you feeling like, maybe we can overcome, or it's an idea that whose time has come and gone?
What? Which thing is? You mean the goddess or what?
Either the goddess as or deity archetype or ideal, or her ideals may actually, catch hold to that 12%.
I think we
can make things change.
We're far more aware of nature and what we're losing in the environment. Maybe not as much as yet as so that to stop some of our. The deforestation and the spoiling of the seas and all those other things, but I think that there's much more consciousness now that we are can't go on despoiling nature forever. That we're running out of the good things that are here. I think that's but unfortunately we live in a capitalist society in which the motivation for everything is how much money you can make.
Right. Well, I keep hoping that this last Wall Street meltdown will, start to open some people's eyes and help this shift in the direction we believe things should go in. But maybe that's wishful thinking.
Now, one thing that I see in the universities, which is very optimistic, is the desire of young people certainly to serve, do something useful with their life, whether it's teaching or doing something in overseas in the world of helping in some way to alleviate situations that are humanitarian disasters and things like that. I think that, of course, I'm here in Boston where we have a very large university population, and can't say everyone, but certainly a large percentage of people now have an experience outside of the United States, which can only be good.
Okay.
Because it opens them to expectations or to possibilities of a life that's different than what they've known.
Right.
And then once they start asking questions, they can grow from that.
Okay. Well, you said you had prepared some thoughts you wanted to share with listeners. If we haven't already covered some of it, would you like to share that?
Yeah, I think that one thing, there are several things that I want to say. That one is that certainly about the sexuality is sacred and an intimate relationship that's not just instrumental. And for a woman, her bodily life stages, puberty, sexual initiation, pregnancy, motherhood, menopause, are all the possibility of becoming, not just physically, but spiritually. As our bodies change, we change. And if we become aware of this, and this is so important in my own lifetime when I was menstruation was something wasn't even talked about, let alone, and certainly, although as college undergraduates, we certainly talked about sex and sexual initiation. It wasn't, it still was kind of under the table. And the fact that the whole way in which a woman, once you have become a mother, your life changes forever. So but we don't hold motherhood as sacred in our culture. In fact, an example of that is the unwillingness to support welfare, single mothers on welfare.
Right.
Then I think we need to listen to the wisdom of our bodies. And to feel more deeply. For instance, during menstruation, many people aren't even aware of the mood changes. I mean, there's much more awareness than there used to be. But we need to pay attention to pain and hurt.
Let's face it. We have pharmaceutical companies telling us that, just take a pill and we can do away with that little nuisance you have every month,
But that isn't what nature intended.
Exactly. It's getting us further and further away.
It's awesome that our relationship of our monthly bleeding to the cycles of the moon, which makes us certainly must be shows our very intimate connection to nature as women.
Well, and that you know, we don't see that as a life enhancing, empowering thing anymore. Although there are these groups like the Red Tent and you know, different other organizations now that are trying to help women have a more positive relationship with their body and their menstrual cycles, which is fortunately a good thing.
Another thing that I is what I call maternal caring, and you don't have to be a mother to have maternal caring, to care for the planet, for peace, for poor or disadvantaged people, but you can still have the dip into the compassion that a mother lavishes on her young child. And we need to, I mean, when there are big disasters like the earthquake in Haiti, Americans are very generous people, and they respond to those things. But this isn't part of our everyday kind of awareness of how, well, even now, we're all surrounded by people who've lost their jobs and lost their homes and in dire circumstances. And from my point of view, we need just to downscale our expectations and stop being so greedy.
Well, I agree with you there, that's for sure. So Eleanor, obviously your book, The Once and Future Goddess, I mean, it's still, thank goodness, it's available everywhere. But your new project, when will that be available?
Oh, I don't know, because I haven't found, I'm working on getting a publisher now. Now, what's so interesting about this village goddess in Orissa is that she's every village, and there are 51,000 villages, everyone has their own, and she has her own name, her own origin story. She's a tree or a rock in her primal form. And those trees and rocks are actually in prehistory in the Western world as well, the first forms of a sacred icon. But anyway, these village goddesses are the protector of the territory of their village. And the villager, particularly the women, because the men are afraid of her, particularly the women, have these dialogues with her. Now, they call it a dream. But it's not a dream like we have dreams. It's more like a vision. But anyway, they have these conversations with her at night. And as they say, she can't always help, but she always listens. And think how comforting that is, to have some larger persona who always listens to what your problems and troubles are.
Well, that's the universal non-judgmental mother.
Yes, that's right. She's not totally non-judgmental. If you're doing things she doesn't like, she tells you.
Oh, she will. Okay.
Not Virgin Mary.
well, now, you know, for the sake of our listeners who, you know, may be under the illusion that, you know, that some of the British were when we first came to India, can you talk a little bit about how Kali has been misunderstood?
Yeah, well, Kali has been gentrified by, particularly by Americans. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Kali, who is the patron goddess of Calcutta, but she wasn't so important until about the 18th century, you know, sort of the colonial British who really probably created the conditions that made her so important. But she is represents, among other things, not only death, but time. I mean, like the word in India for time is Kala, but and so it's the time marching on. But what has happened in the last 200 years in Calcutta is that she has become gentrified. So whereas she was really most distinguished by her bloodthirstiness, because she, it's Kali's image is this beautiful woman who has a garland of skulls around her neck, and who is has an apron from which are hanging arms and legs that have been cut off, and then she's in her right hand she has a bloody scimitar, a sword, a sort of curved knife sword, which the blood is dripping down from. In the other hand, she has a severed head, so she's pretty horrible looking. But what they would say in Calcutta about her than just the way I described her is how beautiful she is. So it all, that's all in the eye of the beholder.
Obviously.
Yeah, and they call her Ma Kelly, Ma being, you know, mother.
The mother aspect.
Yes. Not that she has any children. She doesn't. She doesn't have a consort or anything. But that sense of Ma, and this is interesting because this is true of the village goddess in Orissa as well. This is not Ma in terms of your biological mother. It's rather Ma as a force of nature, and out of which, in one sense, life comes, but certainly not even in that sense as much as a force of nature, which is so powerful.
Okay. So what were some of your, you know, maybe most potent experiences when you were in India?
Oh, there's so many. I don't know. A lot of it is, you're very privileged as a Western woman, a white woman in India, it's different for young women because they tend to get a lot of sexual harassment, young Western women. But when I was already in my 40s when I went to India, so I was over the hill from a certain point of view. But the sense of power in a way that, it's not necessarily good. It's a power that came from being white, being thought of as being European, excuse me for sneezing.
Sure.
But a power that I would never have felt in this culture. But it has, for me, some of it was made me very uncomfortable because I didn't like to be a source of so much privilege. But on the other hand, it gave me access to, particularly when I was in Delhi, where I spent a lot of time, Delhi is the capital city, it gave me access to a certain, the intellectual and artistic elite, and therefore an opportunity to not only talk or give talks at special events, or even places where the Dalai Lama would be the keynote speaker and I'd be on the program. When I saw as my one of my functions or was not only to learn, which I was always learning and eager to learn, but also to be a bridge, a cultural bridge, and that's hard because in a place like India, and I guess in most of the world, people's idea of what the United States is like is what they see on television and things like programs like Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
And or one of my servants, for instance, and everybody has in India, any middle-class person always has servants there, which is something we don't have the pleasure or the privilege of in the United States, where we do everything by ourselves. But and there I had this 16-year-old boy who worked for me, and I decided one of the things I did was teach him how to read. And, of course, I couldn't teach him in the Indian languages. I didn't know them then, but I taught him in English. My children, my sons who were 10 and 12, and I would do his lessons with him every night. Anyway, in his primer, it was when he got to R, it said R is for rat. And Peter, and we would say, oh, we have rats in America. And Peter, that was his name, would say, oh, no, there couldn't possibly be rats in America.
Oh, because he thought it was such a clean and beautiful and perfect
place.
That's
right.
Oh, gee. It's funny.
Anyway, in India, there's the best of everything and the worst of everything. And the worst, once I was in Mexico City and I asked the taxi driver to take me to the worst slum in Mexico City, and I walked around there and I thought, oh, this is nothing compared to what I saw in India.
Right.
So, but with this, and even in the dire, desperate poverty, there's people, for the most part, have some, I won't even say hope, but they have an acceptance of life. Of course, that works both against them because they don't all fight to, you know, to make things
better.
To
better themselves, right. Well, that seems to be something I've noticed myself. They seem content with the way things are, and I just can't imagine why they aren't rioting in the streets, you know, to improve their living conditions and economic conditions and everything else.
Well, you know, India has solved its food problem in the fact that they have sufficient food, but the distribution is the problem.
Right.
And also, once I was in the mountains, and I actually in the foothills of the mountains in the western part of the state, and down at sort of sea level, there were fertile land, and everyone had more than enough to eat. And then as we walked up the hills, things got poorer and poorer, and finally we came to a place after walking a couple of hours where the children all had bloated bellies and sores all over their bodies. And India is a place where if you put a seed in the ground or a piece of a banana tree or something, in 5 weeks you'd have bananas. But I asked why they weren't doing this, and it turned out that they had no water, that they had a well, but the well had gone dry.
Mm-hmm.
So such simple something that water is a very, very serious problem in India. It will be everywhere for us, but it certainly is right now in India. Delhi, they say, is going to run out of water in the next 10 years. Or their
so
water.
Is it an issue of privatization that
that's part of it. I mean,
in Orissa,
people are buying up the groundwater and selling it.
You wouldn't think that should be something that would be possible on the planet.
But people will do anything, for, you know, and India is not a place that is free from corruption, so that if you have power, you can get away with almost anything.
Well, Eleanor, what haven't I asked you that you would think would be important to leave, you know, with our listeners as such an important foremother?
I think that most important is for us all to really search within us this for our authentic self. And this authentic self is in touch with the life force in ourselves. And then if we can really do this, we don't have to pretend, and we don't have to have all these shoulds, and we can let go of the materialism and the greed, which is the paramount force in our culture. And we certainly can learn to live with much less than we have and share much more. And also, if we don't need all this material, I mean, everything is so out of balance in the world. And there's such a sense of, I feel, of satisfaction and even of joy in feeling that you are useful in the world rather than using the world.
You know, I think if the goddess could come on the radio show and speak to us, I would not be surprised if she said the very same things.
Well, that's among the things that I've learned. And it's, you know, people always say, well, what does the goddess tell you? Well, I say, well, it's not like the villagers in India. I'm not in direct dialogue with her. But in my dreams, she sometimes speaks to me.
Okay. Well, Eleanor, thank you so very much for being on the show. Thank you for your tenacity to keep, you know, rescheduling with us till we got this right. And quite frankly, I'm having some technical difficulties right now, and I'm probably going to end the show before the two-hour time it usually ends. And I hope we've actually gone live tonight. I'm a little bit concerned, to tell the truth. This has never happened in you know, the year I've been here on Blog Talk. So I hope we're actually streaming out to listeners, and you know, they've actually had the benefit of all of your wonderful insights tonight. So,
thank you, Karen. And if not, invite me again.
Okay. Thank you so very much. I appreciate you, and thank you for the wonderful book. And I will let you know if the technical difficulties were surmounted and we actually got on the air.
Okay. Thank you. Good night.
Good night, Eleanor.
Bye.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. And if you've been listening, you know we're having some technical difficulties tonight, and I'm going to go ahead and end the show at this point and forego the What's the Buzz segment, but have no fear. The topics I was going to cover tonight, I will cover Wednesday, but I am going to call the show, over tonight, and I'm going to close with just a brief prayer from the Goddess Temple. I want to thank you for tuning in, and if you've been experiencing any audio difficulties like I have, thank you for your patience, and we will. I don't know what this is all about. I don't really have any control over it, but we will, we are trying to, to get through tonight with a minimum of inconvenience to anyone. So this prayer from the Goddess Temple, Great Goddess, the life force in all quickens within as the season lifts from the dark of winter to the growing light of spring. With gentle anticipation, I feel myself enlivening in a fresh new way, once again expecting powerful and good things to continue to blossom in my life, just as spring will blossom into the fruiting of the summer. I am deeply grateful for my part in the great wheel of life. I stand in reverence to all forms of you. Thank you, Mother, and blessed be. Well, good night, listeners. Thank you for tuning in tonight, Monday, on this special show with Eleanor Gadden. And I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll tune in on Wednesday for our regular show on the 28th. We have Max Dashow. Thank you very much, and good night.